Ohio lawmakers are pushing for a statewide ban on cell phone use in middle and high schools, but some local schools have already put their own restrictions in place. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll talk about how school leaders have cracked down and the surprising response from students. Plus, has any progress been made in negotiations between the Bengals and Hamilton County over a new Paycor Stadium lease? We'll also discuss how extremism has changed in Ohio since the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And we'll hear what grade our region got for air quality from the American Lung Association. We've got a lot of ground to cover today. Joining me to get us started are Cincinnati Inquirer education reporter Madeline Mitchell. Welcome back, Madeline.
Thanks for having me.
And WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thanks for being here, Zach.
Good to be here, Lucy.
It's great to have you. I always love talking with you two about education. Zach, state lawmakers in Ohio have introduced this bill related to schools and student cell phone use. Explain what that bill would do.
Yeah, so there has actually been a couple of bills introduced recently. So one of the ones that was introduced last month was House Bill 485, and this would require schools to adopt a safety policy for student access to internet and provide instruction on social, emotional, and the physical effects of social media. And part of that, within that, is a cell phone ban. And then something that happened earlier this week was House Bill 250, which was recently passed by the Senate. And really that is a modification of some of the military enlistment seal requirements for high school. So it's just a modification of that. And within that is a cell phone ban. So we haven't really seen a bill that's just like outright a cell phone ban. It's kind of mixed in with some of these other bills that are in the state house.
Okay. And do you all get a sense, is this is a statewide ban on cell phone use, something Governor Mike DeWine and Lieutenant Governor John Husted support? Is that something either of you have looked into?
They have definitely signaled their support for a cell phone ban like that.
Okay. Okay. Great. Madeline, school districts in Southwest Ohio already are handling this issue in a variety of ways. What are some of those policies?
A lot of schools are leaving it up to the teachers. So what I found really in the last few weeks is that it's really very different district to district. Some districts are saying, you know, no cell phones anytime, make sure they're in your locker or in a backpack. Obviously, that's really hard to enforce. I mean, kids are masters at sneaking, you know, in their hoodies or however they're looking at their phones. Other schools, you know, they don't really have a strict policy. They're saying kids maybe shouldn't have them during the class time, but they can have them in the hallways. They can have them at lunch, before and after school. And even within some of these districts, it's different school to school. So you might have a different policy in your elementary schools than you do in your high schools. And it's different classroom to classroom. I mean, we have some districts that are saying teachers can, you know, take away kids' phones, or they might even use the phones during class to do different assignments. So it's really different school to school and district to district.
And Madeline, you focused on a local school that bans cell phones completely during the school day. Tell us about that school and its policy.
Yeah, so this was at Cincinnati Country Day School, and it's a very small private school. And I think that is one of the reasons why it was easier to implement, because they've got a very close-knit community. It's a smaller building. But what happens at Country Day is that kids come in the mornings. There's a sort of like one of those shoe organizers that you might see on the back of your door. And kids in their homerooms, they have to put their cell phones in one of those little pockets. And they can't get it until the end of the day. And this is so different from even other schools that do have quote-unquote cell phone bans. Because again, in these other schools, you can't really enforce it in a way that that Country Day is doing it, because kids physically don't have their phones. So at the end of the school day, wherever you are in the building, you have to go back to your homeroom teacher, which might be on the other side of the building. Then you can get your phone. And yeah, it sounds like it's been working. The kids actually surprisingly like it.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit more about what you heard from students and teachers about that approach that's so different from what so many other schools are doing.
I think in the beginning, there was some pushback. Obviously, kids were not super thrilled to have their phones taken away. So the kids I talked to said that the first couple of weeks was definitely difficult. And then all of a sudden, they started to feel really free. You know, I definitely feel this way with my phone, and I think in the news industry too, where we're constantly checking. We've got all those notifications coming through. I mean, I every 5 minutes feel like I'm looking at my phone, and these kids feel the same way. For them, it's social media, it's Snapchat, it's Instagram. I don't think they're on Facebook anymore, but you know, but they're constantly checking just to see what else was posted, what new video is up on TikTok, etc. And to not have that, you know, the first couple weeks, like they said, were a little hard, but then it felt like they could focus better. They were taking better notes. They were having better conversations with the people around them, right? They were talking to people that they might not have otherwise talked to, because in the hallways, everyone was down looking at their phone before. Now, walking from class to class, they're saying hi to each other. You know, they're talking to kids that they might not have been friends with before. And I think this is really important, too, for kids that maybe didn't have a phone at all before. I talked to one student who said, you know, she didn't even have a phone before this ban, but the lack of a cell phone policy still hindered her from making connections. Because even though she didn't have the phone, everyone else did, and they would always be talking about whatever video they saw on TikTok, right? And she's not a part of that world, so she felt really excluded. And now that everyone's on the same playing field, it's a lot easier to make those connections as a student.
Sure, just even make eye contact.
Right.
I mean, it's got to be so isolating if you're the only one who doesn't have a phone, everybody's staring at their phones, and you're just staring at the lockers or whatever. How did parents react to this policy, Madeline?
So the headmaster of the school said there was a little bit of pushback from parents, and it was around this idea of safety, which is completely valid in this day and age, of course. But, you know, I think back to I think this was September of 2022, there was an active shooter kind of alarm that happened at Princeton High School. There was not actually an active shooter. But all of the kids were freaking out because they were on a lockdown, and they were texting and calling their parents and saying people are being shot. It was so scary. And you had parents rushing to the building, and that actually really hindered the emergency response that police had, because it was out of control. And so I think that that's something that we need to think about when you have these concerns about safety issues and, oh, I want my kid to be able to call me if there's an emergency. You really want to be getting accurate information, and kids are not always the most, you know, accurate sources of information. So I think that was the biggest issue that or concern, I guess, that they were getting. But when you really think about it, you want to be getting that kind of information directly from the school, directly from the police. You don't want your, you know, 9-year-old calling you when there's that kind of a situation.
Yeah. And it sounds like from your story that school leaders really thought about that, talked to parents, talked to authorities, and decided what you said, that the most accurate way to get that information to parents was not through kids' cell phones.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Zach, you reported on how some other schools and districts in the region are handling cell phones. What's Yellow Springs Schools doing?
So what Yellow Springs did in January of this year was they implemented a new cell phone ban policy. So I think it's important to note that for a lot of school districts, the policies look different. So at Yellow Springs, what they do is now they put the students put their cell phone in a little pouch in the morning when they come in, and it stays in that pouch all day, and they can't open it until they leave at the end of the day. So they actually still have their cell phones on them, but it stays in this pouch. The pouch doesn't open, or at least they're not supposed to open the pouch during the day. And that's how they've gone about enforcing their cell phone policy. And their superintendent said it's been working really well for them. Students are actually in favor of something like this. They said that, you know, students actually understand that all of this cell phone access and exposure to social media isn't actually good for them during the school day. It doesn't help them concentrate. So while they may be a little resistant to it, they recognize that it's something that is good for them. They just need somebody to actually enforce it. And that's the big part of this, is how schools are going about enforcing it, what kind of strategies they're going to use. It varies on between each district.
I thought of this as the Dave Chappelle policy because Dave Chappelle lives in Yellow Springs, mm-hmm. and my understanding is that he requires people to put their cell phones in pouches or lockboxes
yes.
for his concerts. So.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, okay. Dave Chappelle does that for his stand-up shows. A lot of comedians do that
yeah.
as well.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm glad Yellow Springs. It's very consistent all
across
throughout
the
Yellow
board,
Springs.
Yeah.
What about Deer Park schools?
Deer Park has had a similar policy, and what their principal said, the principal of their junior and senior high school, said that it's important to have these rules enacted at a district level. I know there's some school districts out there that don't necessarily have a district-wide policy, so that leaves it up to the schools themselves or the teachers themselves to create their own policy. And what Deer Park was saying was it has to come from an administrative level, if anything, just to give students somebody to blame that's not directly in front of them. The principal said that, you know, kids actually can get behind this and go along with this rule if you feel like you're on their side. So the principal says, hey, it's not me, it's the administration. Help me out. Do me a favor. Put your phone away. It'll be good for the both of us. And that's generally how you have to go about enacting these policies, because there's always going to be a little bit of resistance at first for students. But so far, school districts are saying that they're going along with it pretty well.
Classic parenting move. It's not me. Your teacher's making you do this homework. I think that's great. And Zach, St. Bernard, Elmwood Place, and Mount Healthy City Schools face a different situation with their students, right? Tell us about what you heard from them.
Yeah, so a lot of school districts that I spoke to this week, they come from varying different economic backgrounds. And the thing about St. Bernard and Mount Healthy is they are higher poverty districts. So they've actually seen a little bit more resistance from their students and families in their community about this because they really do desire that kind of connection. And part of that is, as I spoke to someone from Mount Healthy, is, you know, these students have maybe some more responsibilities at home. They might have a younger sibling that they're responsible for during the day, or other things going on in their neighborhood or at home that they really need to be tapped into and know about during the day. So for them, it's specifically Mount Healthy. They introduced a policy at their middle school. They called it a phone home box, where students come in when they come into class and put their phone in the box. It's just at their middle school right now. It's not at the high school level yet, just because they are worried about some of that resistance. But what they're trying to do right now is have it for the middle schoolers. And then next year, they're going to enforce it for ninth graders, next year, 10th grade. Eventually to the point where everyone at their junior and senior high school will be under this new policy.
Yeah. It's so interesting that districts have taken these different approaches or finding things that work for them. We were talking about Governor DeWine and Lieutenant Governor Husted earlier. I know you were at that news conference with Lieutenant Governor Husted. My understanding was that they would like districts to think about these bans, but that they're not necessarily quite on board with state laws. Is that what that would require a some kind of ban? Is that what you heard from Lieutenant Governor?
Yeah, Lieutenant Governor Husted said that he's not in favor of a sweeping ban, a one-size-fits-all ban for every school district. They're really looking for something that provides guidelines for districts to follow and create their own policies. So that's what they've said they're in favor of. They're in favor of school districts being able to make those policies and having kind of some state guidance behind them so it can be more uniform. They're really trying to figure out really what's working right now. So that's why they've been traveling around the state, talking to all these different school districts. They didn't just come here. They were in Columbus and everywhere else, too. So that's what they're trying to figure out right now.
Okay. Were either of you, I'm going to ask you both this. I'll start with you, Madeline. Were either of you surprised by what you heard from educators and students about this? You know, Madeline, you were talking about how grown-ups, you know, are checking their phones all the time. Were you surprised at all by the reactions you heard?
You know, I was surprised by the kids saying, you know, how much they actually liked it. And one thing that I wasn't necessarily surprised, but I hadn't really thought about this, is that a lot of times when kids are on their phones at school, too, it's not that they're just talking to other kids. Their parents are reaching out to them, right? So their parents might be like, how did that French test go? Or, you know, whatever it may be, they might be talking to their mom about feeling sick and wanting to get out of school, that kind of thing. And that is also a distraction. So I think that that's important to note, is that this kind of like maybe almost helicopter parenting, you know, when I was in elementary school and I was feeling sick, I had to go to the nurse. They had to check on me, and then maybe they would call my mom and have her come pick me up. But now you've got 9, 10-year-old kids that can just text their mom. So I think that it's also great to have that kind of autonomy for kids to, you know, they're really independent during those whole 8 hours of the school day. And I also think, I just want to kind of go off of what Zach was saying earlier about the consistency. I think that's so important, like the district-wide ban or policy of some sort, because some of these districts, like you were saying, it's different building to building. Like at Little Miami schools, they've got a very strict middle school policy. Your phone must be in your locker or your backpack. It can't be turned on. The high school doesn't have a policy at all. So then, you know, you've got kids that after eighth grade go to the high school and the rules don't even exist. So I do think that having a policy at all, first of all, is probably good. But then having that consistency just so that everyone's on the same page.
Yeah. Zach, what about you? Were you surprised at all by what you heard from educators when you talked to them about these policies?
Yeah, I was pretty surprised. And, you know, like we said, it's really some of the parents that have to make the adjustment here. One of the things I heard multiple times was, just call the main office. You know, you know, it's especially in an emergency situation, you know, it's more effective to reach out to the school if you have something that's really, really important, really urgent. It's better to call the school building instead of trying to reach out to your student to figure out what's happening. So that was kind of one of the things that I was surprised by, was we're not seeing as much resistance from the students themselves. It's more families and parents who are maybe a little helicoptery and just trying to keep tabs on their kids during the school day. So that to me was one of the most surprising things.
Yeah. I'm surprised because, man, when I text my daughters, they don't text me back right away, but they expect me to text back. So I must have done something wrong. How big an issue do you all think this will continue to be for schools and school districts? Madeline, do you think this is going to be one of those things that just continues to be something that schools have to figure out?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think that once more schools start to really revamp their policies and look into this research, I think just clear messaging to kids, because at Country Day, like I said, after a couple of weeks, everyone was seeming to follow the policy, right? So once you have really clear rules in place, I think that, you know, you won't see as many issues. And one thing to just keep in mind, too, is that this isn't keeping kids, you know, offline. Everyone still has a device. They have a laptop or a tablet that the school provides. And, you know, when I was talking to these kids, I'm like, so are you emailing each other because you can't text? They're like, they laughed at me. They're like, no, we're not on email. But they're on, like, you know, different direct messaging, like Teams channels, Slack channels, that kind of thing. They're still very connected. I think the biggest part of this is the lack of social media, because when it's on a district distributed device, now they can't get on TikTok, they can't get on Instagram, they can't do these other things that are the distraction. I mean, before you had cell phones, people were passing notes, right? There's always going to be that kind of secret messaging, but now it's just more controlled when kids don't have the cell phones.
Yeah. Zach, what about you? You know, we started out talking about this legislation in Columbus. Do you think this is going to continue to be a focus for schools and districts throughout Ohio?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially if we do see a law passed like this, now school districts will have to create some sort of policy. So we will see how that goes for varying school districts. It might be easier for some of the smaller school districts. And, you know, if you look at a place like CPS, Cincinnati Public Schools, how do they go about enforcing it district-wide? Are they going to have a plain policy for every school? Right now, specific schools have their own policies. They might be very similar, but right now it's still at a school level at CPS, I believe, so far. So we'll see, you know, for larger districts with more schools, how they go about enforcing something like this. They might have to get creative. It might be a challenge in certain areas, but if this law passes, it'll be something they'll have to do.
Yeah. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer education reporter Madeline Mitchell and WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, a lot is riding on negotiations between the Bengals and Hamilton County over a new Paycor Stadium lease. So why is the team frustrated? This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A lot is riding on negotiations between the Bengals and Hamilton County over a new Paycor Stadium lease. So how are talks progressing? Cincinnati Inquirer politics reporter Scott Wortman joins me now to talk about what the paper's open records request has revealed. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
It's always great to have you. Scott, you know, it seems like just yesterday the Bengals Stadium opened on Cincinnati's riverfront, but it's been nearly 24 years ago. I guess I'm dating myself there. Explain who owns the stadium and who's responsible for maintenance and upgrades.
Well, ultimately, the taxpayers. It is owned and operated might not be the best word, because the Bengals do, like, on game days, are responsible for, like, managing the concessions, but it's owned by the county and they're responsible for maintaining it. They're responsible for the maintenance costs, and it comes out of the half-cent sales tax revenue that voters passed in 1996 that pays for a large portion of it.
Okay. And when does the Bengals lease with the county expire?
June 30th, 2026. But deadlines are coming up before that. A year before the lease ends in June of 25, the Bengals have to decide whether they want to extend the current lease another 2 years. They have 5 2-year options that they can exercise if they so choose. So basically, the time is now, the team told me, that they need to start knowing where the county stands and what, you know, what officials want to do with the stadium.
I know there's been talk over the past few years about repairs and improvements the stadium needs. What kind of things are we talking about?
Well, right now, if you go by the stadium, you can see that new seats are going in at the club level, like the corporate suite level and the mid-level seating. So when the first game of next season starts, there'll be some new seats, and about 12,000 new seats in the stadium. Then outside the stadium, you'll see concrete work going on, and that's to improve the safety. One of the big complaints, and I heard this a lot actually after the Taylor Swift concert from people, that there's a crush when there's a large crowd at the stadium, and particularly during like some of the concerts, but also football games. There's kind of a bottleneck on the plaza as people are entering and leaving the stadium, going towards like the banks and downtown. So what this will do is create a larger plaza to allow for a better ingress and egress. So all this work will be done. It will be completed before the start of the next football season. And the county's putting in, all told, with that and a few other like repairs, elevators, things like that, it's costing the county about $39
million. $39 million. And you said, oh, that's all money that comes from the stadium sales tax?
Correct.
Okay. The Bengals say the county needs to be doing much more, though. Tell us what you learned from your records request related to the stadium.
And I had asked the county for any communications related to the stadium negotiations in January, because I just kind of wanted to see what the lay of the land is. I mean, for as long as I've covered the county for the past 8 years or so, they being county officials and the team have said, we'll have to start negotiations by 2024. So here we are, because, you know, 2 years ahead of the lease expiring, they wanted to, you know, get the negotiations going. And what I found was that the county has repeatedly told the Bengals that they aren't ready yet. We don't know what needs to be done to the stadium. And the Bengals are getting anxious now that we're 4 months into 2024. The Bengals told me they still don't know where the county stands and when they'll let them know what they want to do with the stadium.
What kind of proposals has the team made?
Well, I've been told they've made several proposals, although they wouldn't go into specifics in some of the earlier ones. But the last one that was leasing the communications was in August of last year, when the Bengals vice president said offered to extend the lease for 5 years, meaning they would be committed, you know, to playing in the stadium through 2030. And in exchange, the county would invest $150 million this year and $150 million next year into upgrades and maintenance of the stadium. And the team would kick in $50 million. Now, they didn't specify exactly what would that money would pay for. But there was a report that came out in 22 that outlined that the stadium over the next 20 years, just to be in good condition and be, you know, a decent NFL stadium, needs about $500 million in upgrades and upkeep.
Mm, that's a lot of money. How has the county administrator responded to that proposal, that $150 million and then another $150 million and for basically a five-year extension?
Well, Jeff Valuto, the county administrator, told me, I mean, they're committed to making sure the stadium stays in good shape, but that a $300 million price tag for just a five-year extension is a bit too steep for them. They would want a longer commitment than just 5 years. They said it's a good start, but that it was too expensive for not enough time, basically.
What are county commissioners saying about all this?
Well, they're anxious to start negotiations as well. Commission President Alicia Reese has been most vocal about what she wants in a new lease. In fact, this past meeting, and she said this before, that she wants more buy-in from the state and from the NFL in terms of paying for whatever needs to be done to the stadium. But she said specifically this past week that she wants at least $100 million from the NFL to put into Paycor Stadium. And that would be comparable to other similar deals like in Tennessee and I think Baltimore. I can't remember all the cities, but she said that that would at least show that the NFL, you know, respects Cincinnati, values Cincinnati, and that it's she feels the league owes the city.
Hmm. I didn't realize the NFL had kicked in on other stadium projects. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You talked to a lawyer for the Bengals. What did he tell you about all this?
Well, he didn't comment specifically on Alicia's proposal, but he did say that they do want to see more buy-in from the NFL and the state. They wouldn't cite specific. He wouldn't tell me like specifically what they're going to ask and exactly what that funding mix would be. But they do seem in agreement that there should be more sources than what is currently the previous lease that has been condemned by a lot of critics as lopsided to putting too much onto the taxpayers. They did say that they do want to see more diversified funding sources.
Did he have anything to say about what the county's approach to these negotiations has been so far?
Well, it's really not been much of an approach at all. They've just been delaying, and that's where the anxiety is coming from. It's not so much that they're concerned with what the county's proposing. It's that the county isn't proposing anything.
Hmm. Your story referenced a master plan related to the stadium that I think one of the commissioners talked to you about. What is this master plan? What are they talking about there?
And I'm glad you brought that up because I forgot to explain that. There was that facilities assessment report that I mentioned that showed $500 million in basic upgrades and maintenance, such as what's going on now, like new seats, like scoreboard, stuff like that. But this master plan will be more of the bigger ticket items like that, what other new stadiums have. So what Paycor will need to stay competitive and be a proper NFL stadium compared to its peers. What that is, no one, neither the Bengals nor the county are saying. Now, Jeff told me that that's what they're waiting for before they really get into the negotiations in earnest, because they want to have an idea of what will be needed and what the cost will be before they like start throwing out figures and funding sources and things like that. So that's supposed to come down. They told me in June, it was supposed to come out 2 years ago, but Alluda, the administrator, told me it's taken longer than they expected. But I'm told that the negotiations will start heating up in the next 2 months once that report details what needs to happen to Paycor Stadium. Hmm.
Do county officials seem concerned about what kind of lease deal they're ultimately going to get with the team? You know, you mentioned the county's original agreement with the team has been pretty harshly criticized.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is unanimous that they all feel that it wasn't a good deal 30 years ago. It's too much was put onto the taxpayers. So I think whatever deal is struck, they're going to have to be able to take something back to the taxpayers to show, look, this is what we're getting that's better. This is, you know, how much less the tax burden will be or something, that they can at least show taxpayers that it's an improvement. But what that is, I mean, we'll have to wait and see. I have no idea.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer politics reporter Scott Wortman. Thank you so much for your time today, Scott.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Up next, what grade would you give Greater Cincinnati for air quality? We'll hear about the American Lung Association's latest report card. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The American Lung Association has graded Greater Cincinnati's air quality. We'll hear how the region ranked. But first, how has extremism in Ohio changed in the years since the January 6th attack on the Capitol? Joining me now to break all this down for us are WVXU General Assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey, Lucy.
And WVXU reporter and senior editor Tana Weingartner. Thanks for being here, Tana.
My pleasure.
Nick, how many people from Ohio have been convicted for actions related to the January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol?
It's about 50 out of about 700 total.
Wow. So tell us about some of those people.
So there were various people involved in various groups who were part of the insurrection on January 6th. Among them, I think the most high profile were Jessica Watkins and some folks who kind of like loosely associated with her. She was part of the roughly part of the Oath Keepers group, but had her own kind of smaller group within that she took to the Capitol with her.
Yeah. Transmissions from walkie-talkie app to fellow members of the militia group, the Oath Keepers, placed Jessica Watkins inside the Capitol on January 6th.
Mezzanine. We are in the main dome right now. We are rocking it. They're throwing grenades. They're freaking shooting people with paintballs, but we're in here.
So what kind of beliefs or backgrounds do people from Ohio who are involved in this, what do they have in common?
So this is kind of, I think, a really important point about this issue is there is a broad spectrum of beliefs that kind of fall into these extremist groups, including, you know, the folks who went to the Capitol went for a lot of different reasons. For Watkins and the Oath Keepers, it's very strongly the sort of anti-government, generally kind of a more right-wing conservative anti-government sentiment, believing that the election had been stolen. Some other conspiracy theories about what the government was doing. But I think the main motivation, and you hear in some of the other communications that Watkins beamed over this app that were used in her trial, was basically that the election was being stolen. She kind of rails against Mike Pence for not stopping that, you know, stealing.
Certification, yeah.
Yeah. And so basically this idea that the election's illegitimate, we're going to try to stop it.
Mm-hmm. There were several high-profile groups that have been linked to the events of January 6th. I'm thinking of the Oath Keepers, which you just mentioned, and Proud Boys. What's going on with those groups now?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about this story that I found out as I was working on it is those groups have lost a lot of steam, according to researchers who kind of keep tabs on them and follow them, and both online and, you know, in various other ways. And really, because the leaders and some of the prominent members are behind bars now, those groups aren't as active as they used to be. They might still be around in name, but they don't do a whole lot.
Hmm. Southern Poverty Law Center research analyst Jeff Tischhauser says smaller local groups have replaced those larger ones.
The folks who might have joined a national organization like the Three Percenters or like the Oath Keepers are now more likely to be joining regional militias. And there's a number of regional militias that have popped up in Ohio.
So it sounds like just because these larger groups are out of the out of the way or getting less powerful or influential, I guess, that doesn't mean extremism has left Ohio, right?
Yeah, and researchers, including Hauser, who I talked to, they kind of pointed out that those larger groups that have the name recognition, someone who is becoming radicalized might start there and then realize they're not very active, but that start in that group kind of pulls them into even more extreme or radical groups that might be smaller and more covert, but have a sort of even more kind of extremist point of view.
So what should we make of these smaller extremist groups? I mean, when you kind of talk to these experts and these people, what are they saying about them?
So what I heard a lot from the experts I talked to is that the risk right now for a sort of repeat of January 6th is pretty low. What is kind of concerning, though, is maybe these sort of pop-up acts of violence that might occur at protests or rallies or things like that, and that these groups are smaller and they're not as well organized. But because of that, they're a lot more unpredictable and have like even more kind of extreme and sometimes violent beliefs.
Yeah. You talked to researchers who track white supremacist events across the country. What was the picture in Ohio last year, and how did that compare with the rest of the country?
Yeah, sure. And again, here I want to kind of differentiate between groups. So the white supremacist groups are, in some cases, different than the groups that were January 6th, and not all January 6th groups, even though they might have some beliefs that we consider extreme, are white supremacists. So I just kind of want to differentiate those. So in Ohio last year, there were about 21 explicitly white supremacist events, protests, demonstrations, and that placed Ohio second, according to some of these research groups like the ADL and SPLC, in the country. So that's pretty bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh, that is alarming. What kind of events are these groups targeting now?
What I heard from every researcher I talked to is that pride events, so LGBTQ community events, are a big focus of these groups. I think because that's kind of like where a lot of culture war stuff is playing out right now. And so you'll see, groups pop up that have neo-Nazi beliefs or white supremacist beliefs at pride events. And they're very vocal, sometimes using slurs, sometimes threatening violence. Mm.
Are there particular concerns about these groups and the 2024 election? I know you said the experts you talked to don't expect a repeat of the violence that we saw in exactly the same way that we saw in 2021, but are there other concerns when it comes to election integrity, security, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so one of the things I heard a lot, and I think you can see playing out, is that some of these groups are adopting language that is a little bit more subtle, a little bit harder to parse as like explicitly extremist, and they're trying to kind of like work their way into the political system, either as like poll workers, poll watchers. Some cases they're going for elected office. And these are people who in the past maybe espoused more explicitly extremist beliefs, but are now kind of trying to tone it down a little bit get into seats of power, basically. Mm.
Is Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose worried at all about election security with that in mind?
As Secretary of State, I think his job is to kind of assure everybody that the election's going to be okay. And I think after the primary election, he said, that election went well. There wasn't a lot of question about any sort of misdeed or anything like that. And he's assuring the public that the general election will also be secure.
I know you're working on another installment to this reporting. Can you give us a sneak peek? What are you going to be looking at next with all this?
Yeah, so I looked at a couple initiatives that have popped up since January 6th, kind of to address extremism, kind of prevent extremism among people who might be at risk of radicalization. And so that's including young people. There's kind of a trend of young people being recruited via online sources. And so that's what I'm looking at in this next story, and also kind of gauging again where the threat might be in the next election.
Mm, okay. Well, thank you, Nick. Really fascinating reporting. I'm looking forward. When do you know yet when people will be able to hear your next story?
That's slated for Tuesday next week.
Okay. Tuesday. Tune in. Just keep your radio on 91.7 WVXU all day Tuesday. Well, really all day, every
all
day.
Time.
Thank you, Tana. I knew I could count on you for that. Tana, your turn.
Lucy.
So good to have you here. The American Lung Association released its annual State of the Air report. There's good news and bad news. Let's do the good news first. What's the national picture?
Well, air's getting a little bit better, so that's the good news. And actually, even though Cincinnati didn't rank so great, it did go up. Like, so we still get an F, but we get like a slightly not as bad F.
Like an F plus? Is
that
a thing? Okay. Okay. Well, you kind of got me to the next question. How do we do as a region? You mentioned Cincinnati. What about Hamilton County? What do they have to say about us?
Yeah, so this air report, it uses EPA data, and this is the American Lung Association that is putting it out. It takes EPA data, but it does look at it a little bit differently than how EPA looks at it when they talk about being in attainment for air quality and stuff. So just to backtrack a little bit, we talked to the folks at the Southwest Ohio Regional Air Quality Authority, whatever their acronym is, and they made sure to point out the region is in attainment. So even though we get an F from the Lung Association when it comes to ozone, the stuff that kind of basically makes up smog, we did get slightly better. We had 4.5 days per year this go around. So that puts us at an F, but that's better than being 33rd worst in the nation the last time with 5 days per year at an F grade. And then they also look at particle pollution, and this not so great either. 83rd worst in the nation last year. So meh, but. Yep. So, but some of the other surrounding counties did a little bit better. Butler and Warren got D's, so for ozone. Yeah. And Claremont County, good job. You guys got a B.
Wow.
So that's pretty good. And none of those changed. So that was also something that the local air quality agency points out is a positive there.
Well, and one thing that I wanted to clarify, just because I am an easily confused person, the way these rankings work, the smaller the number is, the worse it is. So if you rank like 42nd worst, that's worse than being 85th. Like
right, yeah.
Okay. My brain was getting twisted in knots.
Yeah, it's
that.
A lot of numbers. Let's just not focus on that.
Right.
But that is good. Yes,
okay.
Good point.
Okay. Okay.
And then I guess we also want to sort of point out that, so it's looking at 3 years worth of data. So this is the report for this year, but it looks at data from 2020 to 2022. So it's pulling that. And there's a little bit of methodology difference. I don't know if you were going to get to this. Maybe I'm stealing one of your questions.
No, you go, Tana. You know where you're going. You just go.
So the way, and this is what was pointed out to us by the local air quality agency, is the Lung Association looks at all the data provided by EPA, and it pulls all the high numbers from all the days, the highest numbers. And it does not take into account some sort of like weather event or act of God or whatever you would say. Something beyond, maybe not act of God, but something beyond local control. So it's not just a company that put a lot of pollution into the air. Something happened. The best example would be the Canadian wildfires. Like, that's not anything that we can control locally about how clean our air is. That's something that's blowing in. When the EPA looks at that, it kind of looks at all the other factors that are going, and it doesn't take maybe the highest thing from every day. It looks at the different averages, takes like the fourth highest from every day when it makes its coalition.
Comparison.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So this is to say, we're kind of optimistic. Like, things looked better this year, right? Well, last year in 2023, which I've just said was not part of these numbers, we had all of those days with the terrible Canadian wildfire smoke that came down. And I think everybody who was here last year can remember, like, just how crazy it was.
Yeah.
Those days are going to be factored into next year's data and probably for the next few years. And so it's going to look horrible, right? Because unless the Lung Association changes their methodology, although I kind of doubt they will, because California always has,
right?
So it's going to look really bad in the coming years.
Yeah. Do not expect a good report card next year. You're not going to get ice cream for this report card next year. If that's what you get, that's not the deal. So you mentioned that you talked to the local experts about this. What did they say about these grades? I mean, what were they saying about the rankings and all that kind of stuff?
They said, it's good to see that information, kind of like take it with a grain of salt. They're not dismissing it, certainly. And it's kind of good to look at all of the data and have some new perspectives on it. But again, as I pointed out, they're saying, look at how the data is being analyzed and take into account whatever. And again, they said, we are in attainment.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
For what that's worth, your air may not be great depending on where you live.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless you live in Claremont County.
Well, I mean, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Then you're flying high with a B grade. Everybody gets ice cream in Claremont County.
You can go to the land of Becca Costello's people.
Yes. Yes, exactly. You talked about what local experts are expecting for next year. It's like kind of brace for impact because the wildfire stuff's going to be kind of. Do we have a sense for kind of where our local pollution comes from? Is it from all the truck traffic and all that kind of stuff that we get from, you know, we've got all these interstates that are going through? I imagine that's...
I mean, certainly that's not helping. That is one thing you can do. We know usually a day in advance if they're going to declare an air quality alert from the local air quality authority. And so, you know, they ask you to sort of do some things to mitigate what you are doing. So, and they try to tell you in a day advance. So if your company allows for work from home, if you know that tomorrow is going to be a really potentially bad day, then maybe you can plan to work from home instead of commuting and adding your extra amount of time sitting in traffic, creating more pollution. You hear those things about fill up gas after 8 o'clock on really hot days, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always listen to those because when you're filling up your gas on a really hot day, you can almost see the little weird, it looks like the air is doing creepy stuff when the fumes are coming out and all that.
That's fun. Let's not start that.
Yeah, let's not do that. I've got a problem, clearly. okay. Well, you all are great, as always. Before I thank you, though, I just want to let people know that next week we've got a lot of great shows coming up on the Cincinnati Edition. You'll want to tune in. We'll discuss the new FTC non-compete ban and its impact locally. We're also going to be joined later in the week on the show by Cincinnati Police Chief Teresa Thigi to discuss youth violence. So that's going to be really important. And all you listeners out there, have you ever been under a non-compete? We want us to give us a call at 513-419-7100. Leave us a message telling us how it affected you and what this ban will mean, and we might use your comments on air. So stay tuned. I have been talking with WVXU General Assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzell and WVXU reporter and senior editor Tana Weingartner. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, the highlight of my week.
Oh, Tana! You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, do not fret. You can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to catch the show Monday because we have a regional politics show with a focus on Kentucky. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.